Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast, where we discuss information you can't afford to live without. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. You know, the third E in our Crash Course series really ought to be the first E if we were organizing them in terms of importance, and that's the environment. Today we're going to dive into the environment by talking with one of the greatest and most influential thinkers, writers, and communicators on the environment, and that's Lester Brown. After a variety of government positions in the 1960s, Lester founded the World Watch Institute in 1974, and along the way, he authored or co-authored over 50 books, won a MacArthur Grant, received 25 honorary degrees, and in 2012, was inducted into the Earth Hall of Fame in Kyoto. In 2001, he founded the Earth Policy Institute, which you can find at earthpolicy.org, as long as you place a dash between the words earth and policy. And I've been following his work for years, oftentimes while peering between gaps in my fingers, because he so factually chronicles the steady erosion of complexity and abundance from Earth's surface. Welcome, Lester.
My pleasure, Chris.
Well, let me start with a personal connection between us. Your book Plan B 2.0 was drawn upon and cited heavily in my own book, The Crash Course, helping me to fill out chapters on soil and water and oceanic depletion. However, the biggest surprise for me when I got the book was seeing that the top quote on the back cover, which reads, "From the most important voice of our time," was by a woman named Judy Hyde, who also happens to be my mother. She was really excited to hear you're going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's just amazing. I had no idea that she was your mother, and I've held her name in high regard for a long time.
Oh, well, fantastic. Listen, let's start right at it. Let's just jump right in. You've been at this business for quite a while. What's your short summary of where humans are at this moment in time with respect to living in a sustainable fashion on the Earth? What do you say when people ask you how we're doing?
We're not doing very well. Regardless of the indicator that you look at, we see signs of change and deterioration. We look at agriculture, for example, and the agricultural system that we now have is one that evolved over an 11,000-year period of rather remarkable climate stability. And now suddenly, we're seeing the climate system start to change. And as it changes, it will be more and more out of sync with the agricultural system. So it's this changing relationship between the Earth's climatic system and its agricultural system that I am particularly concerned about. We know, for example, that from crop ecologists that a 1 degree rise in temperature, 1 degree Celsius, will lead to a 16% decline in grain yields. We're also looking at rising sea level because the ice sheets are melting. If all the ice on Greenland melts, for example, sea level rises 23 feet. But even a 3-foot rise on sea level would inundate much of the land in the rice-growing river deltas of Asia. Half of Bangladesh is within 1 meter of sea level, for example. So a 1 meter sea level rise would wreak havoc with this country of 155 million people. The same thing is true for the delta in Vietnam. A 1 meter rise in sea level there would adversely affect tens of millions of people. So when we look at rising sea level, we're looking at a threat in particular to the Asia, because this is where so much of the rice is grown in river deltas. So that's just one example of the kind of change that we're facing in the world, and it's coming fast. During the last century, sea level rose 8 inches. During this century, it's expected to rise at least 3 feet and perhaps as much as 6 feet. And when it does that, it's going to be a very different world than the one that you and I have known. So that's just one dimension of climate change that I think is going to create some really difficult problems for us. We're going to see, for example, the emergence of two real estate markets, one in low-lying coastal regions like the eastern coast of the United States or Florida, the Gulf of Mexico, for example, where real estate prices will be falling. But in the interior of the country, where people will be retreating to, real estate prices will be rising. So we're going to see the emergence of, in effect, two real estate markets, one very close to sea level and the rest of the country. So these are just a few of the economic effects of climate change.
You know, I was really shocked when I saw the recent UN projections for how much food we would need to grow to have a equitable harvest for the world. By 2050, they were talking about doubling food output. So I guess that's over the next 37 years. And here's the sneaky thing about doublings, which you know, right? Which is means that in the next 37 years, we're going to try and grow and consume as much food as been grown and consumed in all of human history, which is a rather startling feat. How likely is that in your mind?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen. And there are a number of reasons why I think that. One is that as of 2013, about 40% of the world's grain is being produced in countries where the yield has already reached the what I call the glass ceiling, the one that's imposed by the limits of photosynthesis. Once you remove the nutrient constraints on crop yields, and once you remove the moisture constraints, either because you have adequate rainfall or because you irrigate, then the remaining constraint is the process of photosynthesis itself. And so if you look at countries with high rice yields, for example, in Japan, rice yields haven't increased for at least 15 years. They have been flat. And this was after a century of rising rice yields, but they've sort of hit the glass ceiling, the one imposed by the limits of the process of photosynthesis itself. Of more concern, China's rice yields are now just a few percent below those in Japan. So China's rice yields are about to level off as well. And these two countries together account for a third of the world rice harvest. So we're looking at climate effects on food production. We're looking at the limits of photosynthesis that are imposed on food production. And this is one we can't escape. No one has a process that's more efficient than photosynthesis for converting solar energy into biochemical energy that we and other living things can use. So we've got that. A third major constraint we're facing, they're going to make it very difficult to, if not impossible, to double food production by 2050, is the scarcity of water. Wherever you look now in the world where there's irrigated agriculture, whether it's in the western parts of the United States or in the North China Plain, India, just to look at the big three grain producers, we see serious trouble with water. Water tables in the United States are falling in the Texas Panhandle and Oklahoma, in the western Kansas, southwestern Nebraska, and it's because they're drawing on an aquifer that's called the Ogallala Aquifer, which is an aquifer that was laid down eons ago in geological time, and it does not recharge naturally. So once that's pumped out, then irrigated agriculture will come to an end in that area. And we've already seen a very substantial shrinkage of irrigated area in Kansas and Oklahoma, and the Texas Panhandle, for example. China's going to see exactly the same thing, is seeing the same thing, under the North China Plain, which produces half of China's wheat and a third of its corn. So water constraints, and I should note that in the Arab countries in the Middle East, in some of them, the depletion of aquifers has led to substantial declines in grain production. In some countries, 20-30%. In Saudi Arabia, agriculture is going to disappear entirely by 2016 because all their underground water resources will have been depleted for irrigation. So we're looking at, I think, some very challenging issues on the technology side of expanding agricultural production, and also on the climate side.
Now, did you just say that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is going to be without domestic food production substantially by 2016?
Yes. Saudi Arabia is the first country to actually make projections of how aquifer depletion will affect its food production. And they are projecting, and they've done this pretty carefully, that by 2016 they will be out of the business of producing food because they won't have any water left with which to produce it. And in Saudi Arabia, if you don't have irrigation, you don't have agriculture.
I think that puts a little bit of a spin on certain geopolitical maneuverings that are going on over there. That has to be a very frightening statistic for any government when they face something like that. And you know, as I scan the world and all the headlines, I see one where key resources are already materially depleted, and many of these are utterly non-renewable unless you have a million-year or 10-million-year time horizon. First, do you agree that resource depletion is an important topic? And if so, why does it receive almost no attention from policymakers?
You know, it's partly because these are difficult issues to deal with. And I think there's always a hope of those who are in office that the crisis won't come during their term. You know, it'll be for the next guy, the next person in office to worry about. So that's one of the things. But when you think about it, it really is, it's a real challenge to figure out how you deal with things like overpumping aquifers, which is so commonplace in the world. We look at India, for example, and we see a country where it's been very easy for years, decades now, to drill irrigation wells. The result is that farmers in India have drilled 26 million irrigation wells, and they are pumping water on a scale that far exceeds the rate of recharge. As a result, water tables are falling, and wells are going dry. And this is in a country that's adding 18 million people a year. So the failure to mesh water resource availability and population policy, I think when we look back, historically will be seen as one of the decisive factors leading to a potential breakdown in some societies.
It seems to me that there's so much startling evidence that we're rapidly consuming the vital seed stock of our future. You mentioned, you know, burning through ancient aquifers, but certainly oceanic fish stocks, fossil fuel usage. I see signs everywhere, and the world just merrily chugs along, wishing for even more economic growth. You know, that's what every headline screams at us, is that's what we need. What's really blocking our ability to perceive these actual risks? And I mean as a culture, not as individuals. I know lots of caring individuals who are perfectly capable of looking at these tough topics, as you say, but not yet as a culture. So the question is, what do we need to do differently if our goal is to avert the ship away from the rocks?
Well, our culture has evolved during a historical period when growth was the norm, when everything was growing. Population was growing, food production was growing, industry was growing, the economy was expanding, everything was growing. But it's not always going to be that way. And we're seeing already in some countries where agriculture is no longer growing. Indeed, harvests are shrinking because of aquifer depletion. And we're going to see a lot more of that in the future. And what I've been asking myself recently as I analyze this situation and look back at earlier civilizations, the ones whose archaeological sites we now study, like the Sumerians or the Mayans or what have you. And for them, food was the weak link in their civilization. It was food shortages that eventually brought them down. In Mesopotamia, it was the buildup of salt in the soil because of a faulty design in the irrigation system that led to declining yields and the eventual decline of the civilization. With the Mayans, apparently it was deforestation and soil erosion that led to their decline. And so I've been wondering, you know, is food the weak link in our modern civilization too, as it was for these earlier civilizations? And there was a time when I doubted that it could be, but now I think not only that it can be, but I think it likely will be the weak link. And if I were to pick one indicator to track that I think will tell us more about our future than any other, it would be the world price of grain.
Well, that's certainly been an important indicator if you were, say, living in a North African or Middle Eastern country recently, when food prices rise above about 40% of disposable income, social unrest seems to be a stepchild of that process. So I know you've said that food is the new oil. I think that's the context for it. I'm going to, the devil's advocate side, I get these questions a lot. People pull off of Norman Borlaug's work and talk about the Green Revolution and say, we're going to clever our way through this somehow. You know, we'll somehow help plants have better photosynthesis, or we'll genetically engineer very drought-resistant crops. Talk to us about the role of such technological advances in the scheme of the challenges you see.
Well, we've had, during our lifetimes, at least in mine, we've seen an extraordinary revolution in agriculture. Corn yields in the United States today are four times what they were in 1940. Mm. But the interesting thing is that growth cannot continue indefinitely because we are pushing against the limits of photosynthesis. And if you look at corn yields in the United States over the last 4, 5, 6 years, there really hasn't been any increase. Our corn yields have plateaued, just as rice yields plateaued in Japan, and just as wheat yields plateaued in France and Germany and the United Kingdom. We're seeing a plateauing of corn yields here. And that's happening in more and more countries in the world as farmers hit this sort of glass ceiling that's imposed by the efficiency of the photosynthetic process itself.
Now, that increase of a factor of four, full increase in yields, was that on average, or does that mean if I took in 1940 an acre of the very best Iowa topsoil that's available and grew corn on that in 1940 and did it today, the yield would be up by a factor of four? Or does this mean that we've just found ways to take marginal lands and irrigate them and put nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium on them? What's the real driver of that huge increase?
Well, that increase has been the systematic application of advancing technology, in some cases involving irrigation, but in this country, more often than not, it was with rain-fed agriculture. It was breeding more productive varieties. It was applying fertilizer. We now use in this country 12, 15 million tons of fertilizer a year, maybe more than that now, to replace the nutrients that are lost in an urban society. And that's happening around the world. As we urbanize, we have to use more fertilizer because we've broken the original nutrient cycle. When I was growing up on the farm in southern New Jersey back in the 40s and early 50s, all the nutrients, the livestock manure, human waste, everything went back on the land. But that's not happening in the same way now. I mean, people are concentrated in cities, animals are concentrated in feedlots, so we've disrupted the nutrient cycle, and we try to compensate for that by applying fertilizer, chemical fertilizer, which takes a lot of energy. But we really don't have any choice now but to do that.
Well, that's the linchpin of this story for me, and where it connects over to that E in energy is the idea. When you say, you know, we put nutrients on, I'm just thinking energy the whole time, whether we're running a Haber-Bosch process and making nitrogen fertilizers, ammonia out of nitrogen from the atmosphere, or mining phosphate, or potash rock and hauling it in. It's all just extraordinarily energy intensive. And I've seen studies that show anywhere between 10 and 19 calories of fossil fuel energy embedded in every calorie we consume. Some of that going into the production process at the farm, some in the distribution, some in the warehousing, cooling, and cooking processes. But when you add it all up, it's really an extraordinary subsidy. Right now, there's a pretty big push going on in the U.S. to convince ourselves that peak oil is no longer a realistic concern because we have shale rocks that we can start to tap, and that this somehow negates the idea that we have to be careful stewards of energy resources. How do you respond to that?
Well, it does take a lot of energy to produce food. As you indicated, much of that energy actually is, as I recall, only about a fifth of the energy used in the food system is used in agriculture itself. Most of it is in transporting, processing, marketing of the food products and getting them to consumers. I mean, just to use an extreme example, if you buy a loaf of bread for $3 in the local supermarket, probably not more than 15 cents of that $3 was actually spent on the wheat that goes into the loaf. The rest of it is transportation, processing, marketing, et cetera. So it is an energy-intensive system, and the more urbanized we become, the more energy-intensive the food system is. And that's a difficult one now in a world that's highly urbanized to escape. The reality is it's going to take a lot of energy to keep this food system going. And we'll have to get it from someplace. If it doesn't come from fossil fuels, then we'll probably be harnessing wind energy and other sources. Wind produces electricity. You can use electricity for almost anything from producing fertilizer to powering transportation systems, for example.
Right, right. So as you look over the next 10 years, say, what do you think would be the most likely threat to our way of life at this point in time? Is it going to be, do you think, is food the first thing that crops up, or is it actually climate change that if we finally take that seriously, as you well know, to take it seriously would be to seriously reduce our carbon emissions today, not in 50 years or something. And that would be an extraordinary battle to try and get such a thing pushed through. That would certainly be fairly disruptive to our current modus operandi. What do you think is going to come along, if anything, first or foremost in the next 10 years to possibly cause a course correction here?
If I were to pick one thing, it would probably be more extreme climate events. We have seen a really pronounced uptick in the number and the destructiveness of climate events in the last few decades, and I think that's going to continue. And at some point, we may wake up one morning and we'll have, you know, passed the tipping point and say, wait a minute, this is getting to be a bit much, and we're going to have to make some changes. Let's get started. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that food prices will keep rising and creating so much social instability in the world that we'll begin to realize that we've got to rethink our future, and that simply continuing what we've been doing in the past is no longer a viable option.
All right. You've been at this for a long time, chronicling, by your own words, this is a difficult topic. These are difficult subjects. And along the way, you know, things seem to maybe be getting worse in certain quarters, not better. How do you keep going? How do you personally keep moving? I have great admiration for the amount of work that you've done and the persistence. And so it's a very serious question. How do you keep doing what you do?
Well, there are some encouraging things happening in the world today. On the climate change front, I think the most exciting thing that's happening is the closing of coal-fired power plants in the United States. We've now, I say we've, it's mostly been the work of the Sierra Club with some other environmental groups supporting it. We've closed, I think it's 132 coal-fired power plants. This was out of, I think, an original 500 and something. So it's moving in the right direction. Whether it's going to move fast enough, I'm not sure. But it's interesting to see how effective the Sierra Club has been. And their goal is to close every coal plant in the United States. And I think they're going to succeed. It's going to take them a while, and we have to keep developing alternatives every time they identify a coal plant they want to close, they work with the community to develop alternative energy sources and jobs and so forth, so that they can continue without having their lives disrupted by the closure of the coal plants. So that's one of the exciting things that's happening. Another one is the emergence of bike sharing as a means of transportation in cities. Living in Washington, D.C., we now have more than 100 bike stands around the city in this bike share program. And indeed, it may be getting close to 200 now. So wherever you are, you're never more than two or three blocks away from a bike stand. And if you aren't making a really long trip, the bike is probably the ideal way to do it.
And have you been tracking at all the reemergence of small-scale farming that I know a lot of people in their 20s and 30s seem to be very excited about and using very, I think, elegant and sophisticated methodologies too, permaculture design and fairly sophisticated approaches that really require a deep knowledge and a relationship with the land. That's something I've personally been very encouraged by. I'm wondering if you've had a chance to see what's going on there as well.
It's an interesting and I think a very healthy development. As I recall, the number of farmers markets in this country now, where local farmers market directly to consumers, exceeds 10,000. Now, it still accounts for only a small, very small share of the food that's consumed in this country, but it's moving in the right direction, and people are rediscovering what fresh produce actually tastes like after having relied on supermarket produce, some of which had, travels thousands of miles before it gets to the consumer. So farmers markets I view as a healthy sign in the same way that I view the bike sharing program as a healthy development. It's not that the bike sharing program is going to solve, going to eliminate all the carbon emissions generated by our transport system, but it begins to restructure it and to offer an alternative, and that, I think, is a very healthy development.
Well, speaking of good alternative and healthy developments, I'm wondering, you talk about macro things. In my final question, I'm wondering, these are very large macro forces you're talking about. At the micro, very micro level, what do you counsel to individuals who will be listening? What should they be doing to get themselves, I suppose, more resilient in the face of the potential things that you've articulated? But most importantly, to align their current actions with the realities of the limits of the world we live in, what should individuals be doing?
Well, there are a lot of things we can do individually to simplify our lifestyles. One is we need to ask ourselves, do I really need a car? And more often than not today, people don't really need cars. The public transportation system, the bike sharing programs and so forth are sufficiently well developed that life without a car may be a lot simpler. I've not had a car for 40-some years now. And I don't feel deprived at all. But I live in a town where I can walk almost everywhere I want to go, and there's a very good, metro system and a bike share program as well. So it's easier for me to live without a car. This doesn't work for everyone, but it's an example. Another example is we think in the summertime, particularly here in Washington, D.C., we have to have air conditioning. What I've discovered is that in my apartment, what happens to look out over Rock Creek Park, and I happen to be on the top floor of the apartment building, I can do very well without air conditioning just by opening the windows and turning on the ceiling fans in each of the four rooms in my apartment. And the fans use only a fraction of the electricity that air conditioners use, for example. So I just cite those as examples of how we can shift and not in any way be penalized for it or experience a fall in our level of living or anything of that sort. There are a lot of these things that we can do if we just think about them, but we haven't really systematically thought about them because we haven't had to in the past.
I do note that in Europe, they do live on about half the energy per capita that we do in the U.S., so it seems to me that you can have pretty large changes in your energy consumption profile while still having a very very materially excellent life with no differences really that I can detect that are significant. So there's certainly lots we can do. I guess it comes down to being the change you want to see, and the little things really do count.
I just wanted to mention one other very encouraging sign, and that is that young people in this country do not seem to be part of the car culture in the way that your generation or my generation were. You know, growing up in the 40s and the 50s and getting a driver's license when you're 17, something to drive, especially living in a rural community, was a rite of passage. But young people today don't think about cars in the same way. They're much more interested in cell phones and socializing on the internet than using a car for socializing.
Well, my micro contribution to that is my own daughter's 19 and she has no interest in getting a car, and we live in a fairly rural area, but she gets by, it was unthinkable to me to not have a car at her age, but for her it's a whole different shift in culture. And on the macro, if we look at the numbers of vehicle miles driven, it's been trending down for a number of years now for a variety of reasons, but maybe one of them is people, you know, being less car-centric at the younger end of things. So I've noted that in my own life, and I think it's a very encouraging trend.
It is, and one of the consequences of that is that the U.S. automobile fleet has been shrinking now for several years. It's been getting smaller and smaller. People are driving each car less, and the fuel efficiency of the new cars is much higher than the older ones. So we're cutting back on oil use and reducing carbon emissions in a significant way. I don't think fast enough yet, but we are at least headed in the right direction now.
Well, that is encouraging. And with that, I want to thank you for your time. And also, where if people want to follow your work more closely, where would they do that?
Earthpolicy.org. And much of our work is online and can be downloaded free of charge. So, and I do have a new autobiography entitled Breaking New Ground that'll be officially published on the 21st of this month.
Breaking New Ground. Excellent. And the book right before that was?
Full Planet Empty
Yes.
Plates on the World Food Prospect.
Yes.
Full Planet Empty Plates.
Excellent book there as well. So thank you so much for your time. And most importantly, thank you so much for the work you've been doing.
Chris, thank you for the interview. I've enjoyed it.
My pleasure.